Spock!
Ship. Out of danger.
Yes.
Don't grieve, Admiral. It is logical. The needs of the many outweigh
the needs of the few.
Or the one.
Spock.
I have been, and always shall be, your friend.
Tribute, dude. Gotta pay tribute. We lost a great one today with the death of Leonard Nimoy. Was he in any other films? Yeah, I know he directed a couple. He directed Diane Keaton in Baby Boom, didn't he? I think he directed a few movies. Leonard Nimoy was, of course, in all the Star Trek films, and I'm sure he played a role in some other films, but I can't remember any of them. Anyway, it's a great loss, and rest in peace. Condolences to the friends and family of the Nimoys, and we'll dedicate this episode to the memory of Leonard Nimoy. God, there seems like so many great actors and performers have been passing away in the last year, doesn't it? I guess it always feels that way, but it's even more than usual. This episode is very docu-centric. We've got three different segments, if you will. The first one I'm going to put up, and it's a little later than I had wanted to put it up, but there's still time. It's Christopher Allen, who is the founder of Union Docs in Brooklyn, in South Williamsburg. It's currently running a Kickstarter campaign called Los Suros, which means the Souths, which is the South Williamsburg streets, where there has over the decades been a flourishing Spanish community. And there is this old documentary called Living Los Suros, which they are restoring. And it's, again, this is, as you may know if you're a regular listener of mine, this is tied to this ongoing series of segments I've been doing on the subject of film restoration and preservation. So they are in the final hours of a Kickstarter campaign to help raise money for this really ambitious project, not only to restore this documentary that was made in the 70s for TV, but also to make this very interactive website, which focuses on the history of the neighborhood. And it's really actually quite exciting. So we're going to talk about that on this segment with Christopher Allen coming up in just in a few moments. So Union Docs has been around for, I think, 10 years now. I've been very fortunate to have an ongoing association for a good half of that time. I've done a couple of screenings with them, FilmWax and Union Docs together, and it's my pleasure and honor to get behind what they do and to hopefully introduce them to you. So go check out their Kickstarter campaign. Please do me that favor. We'll put up the link, of course, on the show notes, and it's spelled S-U-R-E-S. So if you go to the Kickstarter, you can look up Los Suros, S-U-R-E-S, and find that campaign. And please do consider contributing to it and enjoy that segment. Then we're going to have Jesse Moss, who made one of my favorite documentary films in the last year, 2014, called The Overnighters. This is a movie which you can watch right now. It's on various digital platforms, including iTunes, Amazon, that type of thing. It will be a kind of everywhere, including on POV in the fall. So this was great because I saw it and I immediately wanted to invite Jesse on. And it turns out that I bumped into him at an event, I don't know, a month or two ago. And we'll talk about that, of course, in the conversation. But it was during the Cinema Eye Honors period of time during this week that was going on. And there was a party and we met. And the next day I went to his hotel and we knocked out a really nice long conversation about this documentary. But it's really great, fascinating, and I think came out really well. So I'm very proud of that. So first Christopher Allen, then we'll have Jesse Moss, and then and his documentary, The Overnighters. And then the third one is, I did this interview a few months ago also. It's with Sandy McLeod. She made a documentary called The Seeds of Time. It's being distributed by Kino Lorber. It's mostly out there in an educational distribution sense. We'll certainly put the link up there where you can find the film. But the thing is that when I was talking to her, I just loved the conversation, and she has this really incredible background and history and childhood, and I just really felt compelled. So it's a really long conversation that goes into many different places, because she's also produced films for and worked with Jonathan Demme on quite a few films, including one of my favorite films of all time, which is Stop Making Sense. That film changed my life back in the 80s when it came out. I went to the theater at least 5 times to see that movie. And so here's somebody who was actually on the crew of that movie. And so I wanted to pick her brain about that, as well as her other collaborations with Jonathan Demme. She's also good friends with John Sayles and John's wife. And so that was very helpful, because I've been corresponding with the Sayles about John coming back on the podcast. He was on a year or two ago, but he's going to come back on for a longer conversation soon. And I can't wait, you know. So that was very constructive to sit with Sandy on so many levels. So it's a very long episode, number 276. And I've really been laying a lot on you guys. I've been posting quite a bit, and I know I'm demanding your attention quite a bit. But please do stick with all those conversations, even if you have to, you know, pause and play it over time, because I think these three conversations are all fantastic and important too. So again, number one, Christopher Allen, coming right up in a moment, and then I'll be back just to do a brief intro again to my conversation with Jesse Moss. And then last up, Ms. Sandy McLeod, who is a New Yorker here and made a film called Seeds of Time. All right, so hey guys, this is it. We'll be back in just a bit. But first, here's my conversation with Christopher Allen.
Her, and then eventually you keep wandering around kind of her block and you find it, and then she invites you inside. Mm-hmm. Through the whole thing, it's really focused on her voice, and kind of, she's a great storyteller, so we let the audio lead. This is kind of a fun, I'll just show you one more moment. But so she invites you upstairs, and it's
89 steps, by the way.
Yeah,
89 steps.
Yeah, so that's the title, and it's the conflict.
Let me know when it gets hard, I'll stop.
So she says, she stops, you know, if you get tired, just stop and wait, and then you click to continue. You go up the stairs here by holding button down, and then when you release, she speaks. And she'll keep telling you different things as long time as you stay. And so you can just click.
That's really nice. Yeah, you can see on the bottom of the screen how many steps you've taken, how many are left to go, what floor you're on.
Yeah.
So she's on the sixth floor of a six-floor walk-up?
Yeah, it's a six-floor walk-up.
And she's on the top floor?
And she's on the top, yeah. So you can walk all the way up with her. I mean, each floor she tells you different things depending on what step you're on and where you're at.
And her French bulldog.
Or
Boston Terrier.
A mix.
Okay.
It
could be a...
like a little chihuahua in there,
mixed with a Boston Terrier or something.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But she's wearing a dress.
She is.
So you can skip the steps and then come up to
this is the sixth floor. This is where I live at.
Can you really hear her breath there? And that's really the critical thing. She's getting to be 65 years old now. She can't keep walking up these stairs. And once she invites you into the apartment, you get a little bit of history of the film, and you get to look around her very small apartment that she's been living in for about 40 years. And, you know, she has come to a critical point where she's got to decide whether or not she's going to leave the neighborhood and whether she can keep walking up these stairs. And is there any place in the neighborhood that's going to be accessible to her?
And something she can afford.
Yeah, exactly. And she was one of a number of people who organized in the 80s to purchase their buildings. So a lot of groups of people came together in co-ops in this neighborhood, and she was one of them. And so she's in a fortunate position of being able to sell her place, but at the same time, if she can't kind of find something comparable, she loses out along a lot of the community that she's established here. And so sort of following her job. So she has she had two apartments, actually, and she bought them for $200 each, and you know, and then she was able to sell them. She has to give back a little bit to the co-op, and so she is in a specific situation where some of the money that she would make from selling, you know, will go back into the co-op. It's a special arrangement with the city. It's a more like a split, because these are the thing that's kind of amazing about these buildings is that they've been completely run by the tenants for the most part. So the tenants have a board, and they get you know, so the board basically collects a certain percentage of the profit of the sales that come in. And so she was in a position where, you know, the second part of this, we go actually to the closing room table with her and watch as sort of like the money gets carved away and away and away. And really, this is, you know, this is for her, a woman who worked but also lived on, you know, welfare because she had five children. And was a single mother. She worked most of her life, but still had to have assistance to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. You know, this sale was sort of her retirement. It was everything she's going to have for the rest of her life. And so we kind of watch as that gets carved up and what she's able to do, and then follow her choices as she goes through. And the whole idea was to put the audience in her perspective and really have them experience the space through her eyes. You kind of are walking up the stairs with through her perspective, you know, leading the dog, and there's a real interaction with her voice. So
interesting, because Christopher, as we talk, most people that I talk to, we talk about their film and filmmaking, and yet the way you describe this project is film is a tool to talk about something else, about getting onto something else, which is a you know, series of social subjects, like being able to afford living in your neighborhood that you grew up in, and your relationship to your neighborhood, and as a tenant in the neighborhood, a more recent tenant, but a tenant who's been around now for a number of years, meaning union docs, your relationship to other parts of the community, and film is a way of bridging and of that kind of thing, and learning.
Yeah, that's totally true.
Anyway, it just occurred to me, because it's like, That's we're talking about, you know, that, which is
I mean, there's some the project is really multivalenced, and I, you know, there's
just name the project again.
The Living Los Sures is the name of the project, and it's an expansive documentary project. We've called it that partially just because it's so big. There's so many different pieces, and so there's a film from 1984 that, you know, when we originally found it, and yeah, it was exactly as you say, it was. It seemed as a window into this history that was really hard to enter into, and we saw it as a way to connect to neighbors and sort of understand this place and the codes and the history much more intensely.
What was the name of that film?
The film Los Sures.
So the Los Sures is the name of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
It was taken by like a local.
The film was made by Diego Echeverria. It came out of the nonfiction television lab at WNET, mm-hmm. and it was a production by David Loxton. Very special time in sort of early days of documentaries going on to television. You know, this is a 16mm production. It's incredibly cinematic, not what you kind of expect from early mm-hmm. documentary on TV. And Diego, you know, really spent a lot of time in the neighborhood. He comes from a childhood in Puerto Rico, but is actually Chilean. And and was one of the early reporters in on the scene in kind of the 70s and 80s in New York of Latino descent, and ended up being invited to make this film after having made some shorts. It was his first and only feature film, and it's quite a beautiful piece. And looking at it now, you see things like breakdancing, sort of starting up,
in sure. in the neighborhood in a way that it, you know, is really remarkable. Yeah. And all 84. The history of the 80s, yeah, is all there.
Yeah.
Fashion styles. And they also see a neighborhood that's really suffering, you know, that's been...
Williamsburg.
Williamsburg, yeah.
It's a section of Williamsburg. It's sort of a, not a, let up as the borders aren't as quite as permanently drawn.
Right.
Because it's a more of an ethnic neighborhood within Williamsburg.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a sort of formal district around the South Side.
Okay.
That is, you know, has to do with mm-hmm. zip codes and voting and things like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, but, well, post offices.
Yeah, stuff like that. Mm. But yeah, it's you know, it's more than anything, it's a community. And it the South Side of Williamsburg was one of the most important Latino neighborhoods in Brooklyn and in New York City, and today it's still very strongly a Latino neighborhood and still carries a lot of that tradition and culture, and it's mostly Puerto Rican and Dominican. And yes, in the 80s when Diego came here, it was a community that was also suffering a lot from poverty, and there was a lot of violence and drugs and trouble in the neighborhood. But it was also this, you can see it that in the film, this incredible richness of street life, both in the dancing, breakdancing, and the art, you know, graffiti art, right. And also just in the culture of the elders, the dominoes on the streets.
Right.
And
well, let's think about historically in the city, big cities, the Latinos, specifically, I guess, Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, as you mentioned, it's a stoop culture, it's a street culture, which in a way probably improved the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Because of the potential for crime and all that. That was also going on maybe in the later hours, but, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even at the time that it's you know, a place where there is a lot of, you know, violence happening and there is poverty, it's totally clear that this is, like, a wonderful place for people. And having met so many of the people who came out of that time, there's such strength there. There's such incredible storytellers, and it's such a tight knit place. You can tell that it's marked them forever. You know, people say, like, I don't care wherever I end up, I'll always be from Los Sures. So yeah, and that's been a really another side of the project for us, is that to take this film, which ultimately we found out was very close to being lost. We were projecting a 16mm copy in the
which came from where?
It actually came from the New York Public Library.
Okay.
At the Reserve Film and Video Collection there, and they had the last good copy. They had loaned it to us. We projected it at the Harvard Film Archive and did a screening in the neighborhood here in a church basement. And
for the community.
Yeah, about 300 people came out from all sides of the community.
How did you get the word out?
We put posters up, and we partnered with some of the. I mean, there's incredible longstanding nonprofit organizations in this neighborhood. El Puente, Southside United, HTFC, which also goes by the name Los Sures, and St. Nick's Alliance, and Churches United. There's so many, like, longstanding nonprofits in this neighborhood that are really sort of the core of the community in many ways. So we reached out to them and said, you know, let's look at this film together talk about the history, and got a community panel of leaders together, and a ton of people came out, and it was an amazingly diverse event. There were people from who had been in the neighborhood for a year and people who'd been here for 50 years.
Decades, yeah.
And so that was awesome.
Did they know about Union Docks?
At that point,
when you came
they
up
didn't.
And introduced
yeah,
yourself?
This was sort of our first way to connect, and you know, we'd always serve. You know, Union Docks has been here in the South Side of Williamsburg since 2005. We were sort of a side project for about 5 years, and the last 5 years, we've been doing a lot of activity. But you know, we'd always kind of wanted to find ways to work more locally and work with the existing community here.
Yeah, I noticed that. So, it seems like there's been I vaguely remember a few other things that were going on, which tapped in definitely into this connecting with the community, surrounding community, which I admired a lot. I thought that was really neat.
Cool.
Especially because, you know, you're not in Park Slope. You are in this other neighborhood and it's distinctly different.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's when we came in the early 2000s, it really felt like, you know, this is not the Williamsburg of Bedford Avenue, as everybody knows so familiarly. This is really a distinct place with a distinct history. We wanted to be a part of that and understand it, and it seemed it was attractive in a lot of ways, both in the sense of community and the culture and the music and the street life. And it's, you know, I think for me, what's interesting about living in a city is it's, you know, is all the different sort of micro cultures that exist next to each other. And so this project was a way to kind of learn more about that. And but yeah, I mean, to be really honest, like our work in the documentary arts wasn't reaching that community. And so what we found was we did a lot better when we went out to meet long-term residents where they were at. So, you know.
You got to go to them.
Yeah, yeah. Going to them. Yeah.
No, I noticed a similar, somewhat similar type of experience up at the Maisel Cinema in Harlem that you got to go and you got to reach out to the local neighbors because that's where, you know. And it's a good idea just, you know.
Yeah, and there's the other thing that's the community is so strong. There's a little bit of like, okay, so who are you? You know, you kind of got to prove yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we've have real relationships now because we have been so dedicated over many years, and mm-hmm. people have seen that like this isn't just a kind of like typical documentary project where people parachute in for 2 weeks and then disappear with the footage and do whatever they want with it. You know, we're really engaged on a longer term basis, and in a way, the whole Living Los Suras project has turned into more of an arm for Union Docs as an organization than it is, you know, a specific time delimited project.
Gotcha. Yeah. What's your official role here?
So I'm the founder of Union Docs and the executive artistic director. So.
Executive artistic director. And where did you grow up?
I grew up across the U.S. So I was mm-hmm. born on the West Coast mm-hmm. in Portland, Oregon. Grew up in Chicago, and then did high school in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Wow.
So you've quite been on different. All, yeah. Areas, yeah. And then I've been up in, went to college in New York City and been here since 98, so.
Was there always an interest in film when you were going to, let's say, from the point you moved here, or?
Not exclusively. I mean, I've been always interested in media broadly, both radio,
right.
film.
Well, it reflects in what Union Docs does.
Yeah, I hope so.
You might come here for a film, but also see a photo gallery exhibit.
That's right. Yeah, and we do a lot of work with radio and a lot of work with interactive and
You've ignored the podcasting till now.
No, not at all. We've had a couple podcasting workshops.
Oh, very good.
We had the folks from Radiotopia here. Mm-hmm. We did some early stuff when Radio Lab came out in the early days, like in 2007. Mm-hmm. We had Jad Abumrad here. So mm-hmm.
We
definitely.
Corrected. I stand corrected.
Yeah,
okay.
We definitely love that.
I'm relatively new. By those standards, so that's my own ignorance. Well, that was a little bit of background.
A lot of background.
In terms of you, I mean, the Los Suras.
Los Suras.
Los Suras. In terms of Los Suras, we're not even finished because I feel like it also is tied to these. There's a part segment of it. I guess it's the 60 millimeter print going back to that and making sure that is preserved.
Yeah.
So that is plays a part in a larger picture of this Kickstarter initiative, right?
Yeah.
Is that where that comes in? I understand the interactive online part of it is not, of course, but or maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah, we're at a stage basically where we've been involved in this project for 4 years developing it.
Four years.
You know, there's been a lot of work on the ground showing it locally, mm-hmm. And we've produced 30 short films through our collaborative studio that are all sort of about the neighborhood today. So they kind of pick up on Los Suras and the topics that are in it, but update it today and with a whole set of new stories. And then we've also connected to characters who are in the original film and then produced these sort of interactive elements. And all that work is very close to completion. This is our last year working on the project. It's also the 30th anniversary of the film from 1984, Los Suras.
And the 10th year of Union Docs.
Yeah, and the 10th year of Union Docs coming up, yeah. So these things are all simultaneous. It's an exciting moment. At this point when we are kind of approaching the last stages, you know, we're doing a crowdfunding campaign through Kickstarter to kind of get the word out and to produce an educational package and to take the film from 1984 on a theatrical release, hopefully in the city here, and a lot more.
Diego's film?
Hopefully paired with one or two of the shorts that we've made. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The film's about 56 minutes, so it nicely pairs. And we're talking to a couple big institutions about the possibility of that.
You're going to be screening for a theatrical engagement at MoMA. We can break that news. I'm kidding. Just teasing. I think it belongs there, but of course, you know, I'm sure you're talking to a few other places. So Union Docs 10 years, got this project now. Is a lot of other stuff been put on? I mean, how much of your resources does this take? Because you're not, it's a small operation.
Yeah, we're now three full-time people. It's myself, mm-hmm. Lucila Moctezuma, and Sarah Lerner. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of part-time people as well. and a very encouraging and exciting board of directors. But yeah, it's a huge amount of work for a small organization. We couldn't have done it without working very collaboratively with all the fellows that have come through our programs here. So all the short films that have been made by fellows in our collaborative studio, and we kind of act as producers on those films. But it takes up a lot of resources, and we're still doing 100 events a year here. We're still doing workshops every month, and we still run a program in the summer called the Summer Documentary Intensive. So it's a bustling little center with a very small team.
Just one last thing about the Los Suarez is you're partnering with POV also.
Yeah. POV came in this summer as a and basically invited one section of Los Suarez, which is the web documentary we call 89 Steps. They invited that to be part of their first ever set suite of digital short properties. They're like digital interactive shorts and other types of digital shorts. And I think there were 5 projects that they selected, and we were very happy to be among them.
Oh, so not just you guys. They're dabbling in a few other with a few other collaborations as well. And so do you deal with Adnan?
Adnan is the sort
this
of...
This is not the Adnan of Serial. We want to remind people this is Adnan Wazy, who's an employee...
employee of POV. I guess he's a digital producer for POV, and he has been a supporter of this project for a really long time because POV actually invited us to be part of their first hackathon.
Yeah, the hackathon.
And we came back for a second one later, and you know we also did hacks at Tribeca and Hot Docs, and all of those were opportunities to sort of experiment with the interactive side of this project, which is a really rich component of it. Because one part we haven't mentioned is the shot-by-shot website, which is really, actually, my
taking that original
one.
Diego's film.
Yeah,
and
it starts
putting
with
literally frame by frame.
It cuts it into the shots, so it's
shots.
There's 326 shots. Yeah, we actually started more with an idea of working on a more of a frame-by-frame basis, we realized that there was a much too many stopping points. But working with just one shot was a real revelation to us because it allowed us to sort of see that as just a single image and not just see it as sort of or two within the film, but also like a real moment grab from history. You know, this encounter of a camera and a street full of people in Brooklyn and all the lives that are there. And so we were able to basically using... connecting to people in the neighborhood, doing interviews, showing clips of this around, find out a huge number of stories about what is sort of behind the scenes of the original shot. So we've really deconstructed the film and then let the community sort of splice in their own stories into the narrative, both text stories and photo and video that we've collected. Yeah, there's been some real revelations. Things like a piece of graffiti in the background of a shot and understanding the significance of a whole crew of girls who were associated in a gang called the Stag Girls that, you know, sort of ran these blocks and what they were all about and who they were and what became of them. All this kind of stuff got unpacked from that. Or in another instance, you know, there's a cutaway. It's like a 3-second cutaway to this really beautiful young couple who are sort of standing in a crowd. And we found out that both of them, unfortunately, had passed away. One, the man had died of AIDS. The AIDS crisis was just about to come at that point. Mm-hmm. And the woman passed away not too much longer, but they actually had 2 children. And we were able, through these connections, to learn who their children were and to send them a clip of the film. And they were overjoyed because they'd never seen a moving image of their parents and had only had a few photographs. And so it was stuff like that that just took the richness of this to a totally new level.
Right. It's so wonderful because the power of the documentary film as a vehicle for so much more than just this basic kind of relationship we're more familiar with, which is audiences and the screen, but there's so much more opportunity.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, what you
I mean,
do.
There's just like, you know, this, there's so much else sort of ancillary material that's packed into this film. It's been really endless to kind of tease that out. And the stories have, you know, they're pop cultural stories too. There's like a soft and dry antiperspirant commercial on the background of a shot. And there's, you know, looking just a little bit into that, there's kind of a hilarious context to put the rest of this thing in. And it sort of frames out the story in a more fully imaginable way. So it's both, there's pop culture, there's like stylistic references, fashion, but also a lot about the people and places in the film.
Seems endless what you could.
Yeah, I think, you know, we kind of developed what I think is a very slick website that sort of hosts this. And it's a, you know, I think a lot of people have been looking at ways to annotate video and to try to have a group of people work socially around a video. And I think the way that we've done it is works really, really well, especially compared to what else I've seen out there. It allows like you to focus on just this one shot. And so, you know, basically at the top of the website, the shot plays. And then as you scroll, these different stories come over the shot. And we change the loop in the perspective of what portion of the shot you're looking at. So we can sort of animate the background to reflect the words or whatever images are kind of coming up in front of it. And so it remains a cinematic experience. It's not sort of this, you know, diving into a database or something like that. Hopefully you get the feeling of the people. You hear that, you know, so you get clips of videos and sounds from the neighborhood. So the whole point is to kind of build off of the cinema of the experience, but kind of expand it into this web format that would allow so many more voices to participate.
What's the website?
The website is livinglosuros.com. And yeah, from there, we actually have just for the final weeks of the Kickstarter sort of taken that down for an update that will, you know, to sort of focus the energy on this Kickstarter campaign that we're very hopeful to complete in the next couple weeks.
What day is that? Was it you? It's already going on.
Yeah, it's going on. We're now 20 days left. So that'll be March 2nd. It finishes up on Monday at 5 p.m.
Monday, March 2nd, 5 p.m. Noted. What's the goal? What's your financial goal?
The goal is $30,000.
Mm-hmm. And also to get a large, engaged group of people behind it, you know, which will help, I'm sure, in the next, whatever next steps happen with this, and whether it's a theatrical of it, which is a pretty ambitious idea, I think it's nice.
Yeah. I think, you know, we've had a lot of requests to show the project at universities. Mm-hmm. I think
so it has an educational distribution built into it. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Well, Diego, what's Diego's last name again?
Diego Echeverria.
Echeverria. Yeah. And is he with us still?
Yeah, he is, yeah. We were able to connect with him, I think, in 2009 for the first time. And he's a wonderful man. He has been a big supporter of this project. It was a total gift to him in a way. You know, he didn't expect it.
And it's his, you said it was his only feature he's made?
It's the only feature he's made. Yeah. And he went on to do a lot of really important work, actually, with the United Nations and using media to kind of communicate about important issues and things like child mortality in Latin America and all over the world. So,
What is he in his 60s?
He is, getting up there, maybe a little older. Yeah.
Because I was thinking, you know, I mean, he still can make more.
Yeah, he's definitely worked with us. He's guided the fellows. He's now retired and in Miami. Thankfully, he moved back to the U.S. from Latin America, so he's a little more accessible. So we've had him up every year to meet with us and talk. And then, of course, he was very involved in the restoration process. So, you know, we were able to, with the New York Public Library, it kind of brought the film to their attention. They did the detective work to find out that, in fact, they only had the last remaining good print. And then were able to raise, they got a grant to do a 16mm preservation of it, which is, that's the thing that will be in the vaults that will, you know, make sure it's here for hundreds of years. It's not as high quality of a copy for like theatrical purposes, but it's
preservation though.
It's a preservation. Yeah, the thing is preserved. It's going to be with us. So that's amazing. And then they also allowed us to do the digital work. So we did a digital restoration and a scan at 4K and have this now beautiful DCP. And we still have a little work to do to get that all prepared so we can get it out. And that's part of the Kickstarter as well. But due to that sort of effort, and Diego has been a part of that, you know, throughout and sort of checking in on the colors and making sure it was to his intentions originally.
Mm-hmm. And also we should mention you can find out about everything that Union Docs does by going to uniondocs.org.
That's right.
They're located at
322
Union Avenue in South Williamsburg, just blocks from the L train, the G train, the J.
Yeah, so easy to get to here. It should be.
But it ain't easy to leave.
Right.
No, but they have lots of fun, exciting. I've done a couple of little things with you guys over the years. And, Thanks again for coming on and talking about this. And again, go to the Kickstarter campaign and look up, I guess the easiest thing might to search.
Yeah, Union Docks or Living Los Sures.
Yeah.
Sures is S-U-R-E-S. And it's Los, L-O-S-S-U-R-E-S. And it just means
what does
the Souths.
So oh, okay.
It refers to
the South Streets.
Yeah, South Streets. South First, South Second, South
Third. You're
near
the South numbered street, which so because the residents lived in them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. Makes sense.
That's what it is, yeah.
So. As opposed to the enemies up at El Norte.
Right. Right.
Christopher Allen, thanks a lot for coming on.
Oh, thanks, Adam. This is great.
A few days to go, Living Los Sures has raised almost all of its goal. It's a $30,000 goal. It's raised over $27,000 as I read. So it only has about $2,800 to raise by Monday. So over this weekend, we got to help just give them a little bump. Again, the name of the project is Living Los Sures, S-U-R-E-S. Please, I ask you to go and check that out. Okay, guys. Okay, so here we go. My conversation with Jesse Moss and his film, The Overnighters. You know, it's this pastor in North Dakota. There's a boom there with fracking for oil, and everybody's moving to this town because there's supposedly tons of work, and they get there, and there isn't as much work as they thought, and they can't afford the rents because all the landowners have jacked up the prices for rent, and there's a huge problem with it. And so this pastor takes in people into his church, and that causes a lot of commotion because a lot of these people are, you know, they are some people come from very desperate backgrounds and are looking for, you know, it's a very dramatic thing. But the tone of the film is really, really level, you know, and it's and then there's lots of twists and turns, and I'm sure you've heard about it if you're really into documentaries. So this is the one for you. So listen to this conversation, then go watch The Overnighters. Here's my conversation with Jesse Moss, the filmmaker.
We are on our way to Williston, North Dakota.
Destination, North Dakota.
Hopefully to find jobs.
We're going to go out there and try to find an oil rigging job.
I'll find a job within an hour or two, they said.
People with 10 felonies is getting $100,000 a year.
New playing field with new opportunities.
This may be some point of hope for everybody.
I thought I could come out here, and if I worked hard, was a hard worker, and knew what I was doing, then I'd get a job pretty easy. I'm seeing now that it's not that easy.
I can't afford to live,
and I'm just at the end of my rope.
Nice to meet you. It's funny, last night we were at this party for the ceremony for Cinema Eye Honors, and then the party afterwards, and I think every time I go to these things, I go really because I don't have a stake in the game, but I go because I think I will meet two or three people, even just one, each time I go, and that's like price of admission for me. So, like, you were the one guy, and there may be one or two other people I was thinking, okay, if I can remember, but you were definitely... So I could go on Facebook and start looking at your pictures again just to, you know, do that thing where you can spot somebody like that. But I just asked somebody who was sitting with me, said, oh, yeah, he's right there. You're sitting right next to me, more or less. That's the fun story.
It was meant to be.
The origin story of our meeting together, Jesse. Nice to meet you finally.
Nice to meet you, Adam.
And what did you make of the ceremony last night, the Cinema Eye Honors?
It's the first time I've been to Cinema Eye. It's great to see nonfiction cinema celebrated for a week, 3 days, actually. Not just yesterday's awards ceremony, but
right.
We had a couple of days of other fun events. And I really like the guys who organize it. I think it's a great spirit. Feels like a community, my community. So
yeah.
It's great to be a part of it. I just, all my years in New York, had never been.
So yeah.
I'm in San Francisco.
San Francisco,
I used
right.
to live in New York for many years, but... I moved to the West Coast a couple of years ago.
You're in San Francisco. And I know there's quite a number of documentary filmmakers up there. Do you feel it's just not as, other than maybe like the San Francisco festival or something like that? I don't even know if you have a documentary festival up there.
We do have a small documentary festival. We have the San Francisco International, which has good documentary programming. It's not New York.
No. But that's not fair.
But we have a good film community. We have a lot of great documentary filmmakers. Actually, a good cohort around my age, kind of mid-career documentary filmmakers who I've gotten to know. So I was here for 15 years in New York, which was formative for me. Mm-hmm. I really cut my teeth in New York and built my community here, mm-hmm. and was inspired here.
What years?
I was here from 96 to 2011.
Yeah. Oh, so pretty recently. I see.
I'm a fairly recent convert. When I left New York, I didn't tell people I was leaving. I hoped that way I could slip back if things didn't work on the West Coast. But I really like being in California now.
Okay. It's a nice city, San Francisco.
I grew up there, so I know it pretty well. But it is a great city. It's a livable city. It's a good place to make films. You know, for me, I wasn't sure when I left New York and unplugged from the up escalator energy and ambition of New York, if I could continue to do this kind of work. That was the big question hanging over the decision to move. But I found the most success in my life leaving New York and making the overnighters entirely from the West Coast. Not to say like the money, the support all came from the West Coast, sure. But just, I think, in a way, clearing my head and getting away from New York helped me make this film.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So, because the sense of community, let's say, that does exist in New York, I could see how it would be helpful when you're putting together a team or when you're looking for other types of resources, right? But on the other hand, it's good you didn't. You found a way to kind of create your own.
Maybe I'm writing a correlation there that doesn't really exist in that decision to leave and the clear head that mm-hmm. it gave me in some ways. But right. but I like to think that there was a connection between that decision and finding this film, having the head to find this film.
Well, it seems to have worked quite well because The Overnighters is a really clear-headed film. I mean, it works on a number of levels, but it's just such a story of its time.
I'd like to think it's a very timely story, but timeless in the themes that it evokes in American history, this migration of people to find new lives on the frontier.
Yeah, there's almost this Steinbeckian start to the film.
Sure.
Know?
I mean, we're a country founded on boomtowns and frontier journeys, and the idea that in 21st century America there was a frontier boomtown was tantalizing, mm-hmm. and I wondered, what did that look like? What did it feel like? How could it be? Uh-huh. And that's what drew me out to North Dakota to begin with.
Did you do research on this subject in particular, or just your fascination was enough to kind of...
I mean, I did some reading. I did. Uh-huh. I read about North Dakota, what there was in the press, and there was some reporting about what was happening in the North Dakota oil boom, that this had become the place in America people were headed to find work. I read about oil, too, which has begun to really interest me, the industry of oil extraction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I read Daniel Yergin's book, The Prize, which is a good starting point. But there's no substitute for boots on the ground and really just going up there and getting inside the story yourself. That's what I really ultimately had to do. And that came from reading the local newspaper in Williston, North Dakota, online and finding this story.
Oh, about this particular church, right? And the pastor... Pastor
Jay. Jay. Yeah, what I read, Jay used to write a clergy column for his local paper, the Williston Herald, which is a character in the film, the newspaper. But Jay was a writer for the paper occasionally. And I read a clergy column that he had written in which he called on his community to welcome this influx of migrants who were streaming in to find work.
Right. So for those who are listening who are not familiar with The Overnighters, you've already set up some of it, but it basically there was mostly men. I would almost entirely men, right? Because it's hard labor.
I tend to say men because it was 98% men.
Okay, that's I think fair enough, with a couple of women too, but mostly men showed up because there was this oil boom, mostly gotten by fracking, right?
Are we
jumping ahead of ourselves?
No, we could say that. We'll set the stage. Yeah. The Bakken Shale is a geological formation in western North Dakota and eastern Montana, which they discovered through fracking they could extract an extraordinary amount of oil. Of course, fracking in Pennsylvania has driven the natural gas boom there, but in North Dakota they frack oil. Same process. In North Dakota they burn off the gas, they keep the oil. And it's driven an extraordinary explosion of growth in North Dakota. It's become the second largest oil-producing state in the United States.
After Alaska?
Astonishing. After Texas.
Texas. Oh, that makes more sense.
An astonishing rate of growth and opportunity. Yeah. And that has drawn tens of thousands of Americans of all stripes and sizes out there in search of opportunity, in search of redemption.
Mm-hmm. And It was one of those things where friends, you know, some guys would go there and they would call their friends who are unemployed or underemployed and tell them, like, you got to come out here. There's just tons of money to be made. But at the same time, there are a lot of exploitative landlords. And
there's a land grab, a power grab, there's a resource grab. I mean, it is it's a boom time.
Right.
And good and bad, you know, and that's really what drew me there was to look behind or beyond the surface story of what I was reading, which suggested easy opportunity. And of course, I live in San Francisco. It's a gold rush boomtown, and we're ever mindful of the history that many miners who came never found that gold strike. It was an illusion, really, right? Yeah. The people who got rich were selling pickaxes. And what was true in North Dakota were people finding the work, the job, the living wage job that they were seeking. And that's what I wanted to explore. And I felt like in the big conversation about energy and oil in America and fracking, we weren't talking enough about the human side of the equation, the labor side of the equation. We've talked in very effective ways about fracking and what it means for the environment and the cost-benefit analysis, but less about human beings. And you know, when I came to New York in my early, no, my mid-20s to work as a filmmaker, one of my first jobs was with Barbara Koppel. And, of course, I had known her work in Harlan County, USA, which is a very formative film for me. And that story of coal miners in Kentucky and really the human story of what they were fighting for.
Right.
And so here was a modern version of that epic story. And I felt like, let's find out. Are these people who are getting in their cars, getting on the bus, getting on the train, coming alone, leaving their families, leaving their homes to start new lives? Are they finding that opportunity?
This would eventually evolve, or I shouldn't say evolve, but it would kind of hone in on, it's probably a better way of saying it, this church and this Pastor Jay, right? And like kind of to be your...
Yeah, so I started with this macro focus, but looking, as a filmmaker, always looking for that human story that's going to take me in. And it's a big, overwhelming, complicated story of what's happening in North Dakota. And I wasn't sure how to approach it, but I knew I had to go up. And I connected with Pastor Jay through this clergy column. And I called him up and he said, he was very friendly on the phone. And he said, Jesse, there are men and a few women sleeping in my church, in the pews, in the parking lot, on the floor here. They have nowhere to stay. They can't afford a place to live. They can't find a place to live. They've just gotten here, and they're here. And that was the tantalizing information that drew me to North Dakota. I went right when I got off the plane. I came by myself with my camera. I like to work alone in the field. And I went to Jay's church, and I met him, and I saw that there were indeed people sleeping there. This impromptu community had developed around the church because he had welcomed them. These strangers.
Right. Just take a baby step back. You say you are a one-man crew. Does that mean that you work with a shotgun microphone? Or how do you mic? How do you get such a good sound?
Yeah, I worked with a wireless microphone on Jay, Pastor Jay, my main character, and Sennheiser 416 shotgun mic on the camera, two channels, right into the camera. So just riding the levels as I'm shooting on a Sony F3 camera. So a pretty good camera if you're not, for the tech heads, right? If you're shooting on a DSLR, you'd have to run double system. But that's complicated if you're one person. So a shoulder-mounted camera with a zoom lens and Jay on a wireless mic. Mm-hmm. And that's a way that I made my very first documentary called Speedo, and it's the way I made this film.
What was Speedo about?
Speedo's about a Long Island demolition derby champion who I met out at a racetrack called Riverhead, and the film follows his life as his life at home falls apart. His life at the track is a great success. He's victorious on Saturday night at the demolition derby, but at home, his marriage is splintering. Actually, real parallels to The Overnighters in some ways. A man who's fighting external and internal forces, and it's kind of an action comedy with heart.
Okay. You made that when you were living in New York?
I made it when I was...
It sounds like a 2011, between, you must have.
Yeah, about 1998
right.
to 2000, I shot that film.
And mostly on Long Island.
On Long Island.
Riverhead, that area, I don't know where to begin. Reverend Jay is, you've obviously talked so much about this film, and I appreciate your kind of going through all the paces again with me. But I only saw it about maybe a month or a month and a half ago, you know, and it's an interesting thing. We can't really talk a lot about him, you know. We can talk quite a bit about him.
He's a man of many layers. He's a complicated character. That's what drew me to him. I mean, I could see that.
Profound luck, though, to just the timing of it all. You know, it's one of those things, right, where you just found him and he agreed to do it.
Well, I think it's often hard to account for films in rational terms. You know, they just sort of happen, and if you subject these decisions and these intuitive choices to rational analysis, they break down. Something about that story drew me in, and I think back to what we were discussing, you know, this big, vast story of the North Dakota oil boom, I was looking for a prism that would take us inside and show us what life on the ground was like. And here was a way in, which was in this church, this program of men. Jay called it the overnighters program. That's what he called them, these people who'd come and who didn't have a place to stay, who he took in. Pastor Jay was the man in the middle, because he was at this fulcrum of tremendous forces, this influx of people, and this community that was really buckling under the change. This small town of Williston, North Dakota, kind of a classic Mayberry American small town with parades and small town values. Suddenly, oil moves in, big oil, and life is utterly transformed. And Jay, as a man of the community, was trying to mediate these forces. And I could see that his struggle and the program and the way in which it contained these multiple narratives was something with a possibility. I mean, it just drew me. Yes. And, you know, I didn't subject it to too much rational analysis. I just thought, wow, this is... When I stepped foot in the church, it was so moving to meet some of these people who had given up so much, had staked everything to find new lives. And that's a theme that's really interested me in all of my documentary work, is the theme of reinvention, of self-invention.
Second chance is a better way to do it.
There's no jobs. Indiana has an unemployment rate for high school diploma, no college, of 26%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really bad. And so I tried to get a job. I couldn't get a job. And so I read an article. It said there's boatloads of work in North Dakota. Boatloads. My dad said, well, I can get some money from grandma, and I'll loan you some. And I'll get you a one-way ticket there, you know. And it's been trial after trial. I'm just at the end of my rope.
You can get a job, but you gotta translate into housing. And that's the killer. Rents have tripled and quadrupled. People who lived here all their lives happen to leave. And other people who own property just don't like the changes and they're leaving. They're selling it. But everything's expensive. It's very expensive right now. You know, so it is legal to sleep in your car in Williston. But you can only sleep where people give you permission to sleep, and there's not very many places that do. Anyway, so you can stay for a month, and then unless there's a problem, we do ask a gift. We don't charge this. We're not a shelter. This is a place for men to get jobs.
Two things occurred to me as you talked about it, which hadn't occurred to me up to now. And one is like how, this boom is so spectacularly quick. I mean, it happens so fast within, you know, maybe a year or two. You have this tidal wave of people coming in, and a whole zeitgeist of the community, the whole, you know, is changing so quickly that the people are probably out of sorts with that, you know, and they're the people that are the residents of this town towns.
It unleashed very powerful forces, and the town was unstable. That's what it felt like. It felt like, and it actually made concrete a feeling that I recognize from watching Deadwood. I mean, these boom towns that we know from mythology, from film and television, that seem like they're places of lawlessness and desperados and vice. It's real. Mm-hmm. And when I came to this boom town, I could see this continuum that stretches back to these American boom towns of Dodge City and Deadwood and San Francisco and places that are forged in the American imagination. And here it was real in a modern context, but the instability, the lawlessness, the sense of great riches and utter devastation, of violence, of the battle between fear and hope. I mean, all of these things were present and in a really intoxicating, exhilarating, and sometimes terrifying way.
you were like, oh my God, what have I gotten?
It was a little bit scary, you know, coming alone, not having a crew was liberating, but also a little bit scary. I felt scared initially when I went to Williston.
Scared how? I mean, just...
Like, alone, first of all, but also, like, there just felt to me a kind of lurking... I mean, oil extraction is a violent industry. There was, of course, more crime in Williston. Just the... You feel it in the air. I mean, it's a kind of palpable sensation. And some of these men that I met who were staying in Jay's church, these were people who had been in prison for years for violent crimes, who were looking for those second chances. But so it all contributed to a kind of instability that I mentioned.
And then the other flip side of that, which I also realized as you were talking, was that Pastor Jay was, here was this incredible opportunity for him to rise up to, in a way, to, again, that kind of second chance, that salvation thing that I was saying, where he looks at it as this incredible opportunity to do something to purify on some level. It may not be the right word, but it's sort of...
Well, it was a test of faith for him.
Yeah, well, like this gave him a real cause that was just he could grasp onto. And
He found these are people who had come to find
these
meaning.
Broken people.
These people had come to find meaning in their lives, to find work.
Yeah.
And Jay found meaning in helping them. And I think that he's a small town pastor with a congregation who he served loyally and who he loves. But here he had these people who knocked on his door in a moment of need, and he opened it. He let them in. And many of us wouldn't make that decision. You know, I think we're all somewhat fearful. I think if I was confronted by a community of people parked across the street from my home in a parking lot, you know, that might be a little scary. But Jay, to his credit, this was an act of faith. Mm-hmm. As a Christian, he's a Lutheran pastor. I should say not Christian. I wasn't raised in the church. It's a very foreign world to me, the church. I didn't expect to make a film set in a church about a pastor. But Jay's choice, his choice to act as a good Christian, to love his neighbor. He called these people his neighbor who had moved into Williston, was an expression of the Christian ethic, and he lived it. And that was interesting to me. And also as a non-Christian, reading that as a moral choice that we all face, which is how do we help people who have needs or who have less than we do? And those decisions are never easy. And for Jay, when I met him, he made it very clear that he believed in this cause, but it was not easy and that his congregation opposed it.
Yeah. And here's where we kind of just start treading a little, because he's also has an internal conflict that, you know, he's got this, he's a family man.
He was pulled
in. Beautiful in many, family.
Beautiful, strong
really,
family.
Really strong family. Really back him up, like, you know, I mean.
They're when his backstop. I mean, because very few people did support him. His family helped. They were there. They're a pastor's family. And, you know, there's not a lot of separation between your personal life and your professional life when you're a pastor. It's like being a filmmaker. So Jay's family was there to help him every night. You know, these men would come and sleep in the church. It'd be 50 of them.
Right.
And they would, like, check them in like a hotel. And there were his kids and his wife helping every day.
Yeah.
Whereas the congregation, you know, was not, there were some members of the congregation who supported the program initially, but very quickly turned against it, resented it, resented how these men had taken over their church. It smelled bad. They dirtied up the place and left dirty coffee cups in the sink. They were a little scary. And the congregation began to let Jay know that they resented it.
Yeah.
Jay said to me, actually, one of the first things he said to me, which I think made me believe that there was the potential for a real story here, was that he said, Jesse, I could lose my job for this, but I'm going to do it anyway.
What you mean in terms of the work that he was doing with the overnighters, or are you talking about being in the film, exposing everything?
I'm talking about helping the overnighters.
That's right.
I mean, the decision to be in the film, He opened himself up very, very immediately to me. He welcomed me. I think he felt like there was an important story happening in his church, and he wanted someone to tell it. And he let me in. And, you know, when I first got to Williston, I, like many of these overnighters, did not have a place to stay. I didn't have money for a hotel room, and I couldn't even find one, because all the oil companies have booked up every hotel room in Williston. I asked Jay if I could stay in the church, and he said, of course you can. Sleep here. And so I spent the first 6 months of the 18 months I spent shooting the film, I spent the first six sleeping in his church among the men. And Jay welcomed me like he welcomed them, and he really opened himself up. And of course, we built over time a strong relationship, and that's, I think, was the value of making this film over a long period of time, was giving time to allow those relationships to develop. And, sure. And so that there was, you know, because the film becomes very intimate, sometimes painful. And I think the intimacy of those moments on screen, they rest on that foundation of trust that was built from the decision to come alone and to spend time making this film and to sleep in the church.
I'm kind of, you know, it's interesting. I've not had quite a show where this reveal idea, which, you know, which is part of the marketing language also of the film.
Well, I mean, actually, I should say we don't. That's not language that we use.
No, yeah. Okay, I appreciate that, because I kind of feel like, well, I could talk to you blatantly about everything in the film, and then edit some of it out for now, and then maybe someday, but
To set the stage for that.
I haven't read a lot of other articles. Like, I don't do that too much. Yeah. I read some things, and
well, let me say this about Jay, is that this act to embrace these people was for him an expression of his faith, but it was also coming, and this was clear to me, from a deep place in his heart, in his soul as a human being. And his identification with these men, these burdened, broken, stigmatized men who were not welcome in the community, it struck me as really, there was something about, like, most of us don't have that kind of compassion. And I thought it was beyond theological. It was something about him. And that was the mystery of Jay for me that drew me further into his life and into this story, and which is, I think, unraveled in the film. Is I think you come to understand Jay really as a complete human being. And he lets us into that very personal place.
Right.
And that's what we come to discover. And it's maybe expected for some people, unexpected for others. It certainly comes in a really surprising way in the film, but yet to me is somehow inevitable and truthful.
Feels that way.
And very honest about who Jay is. And I think that's the journey of this story, is really coming to, I mean, in a way the film is a kind of a bait and switch, and was for me. I came thinking I was going to tell the story of these overnighters. We do meet in the film. There are four of them who we really get to know.
One of whom, because he's just too much of a liability, right, to stay in the church. Once people find out about him, the neighbors, the community find out about him. So the family takes him in.
That's
that
right.
House.
Yeah. I mean, Jay faces this profound test in the film, which is the newspaper discovers that one of these men is a registered sex offender, and they begin to snoop around. And this information threatens to jeopardize the entire program. If this, they go public with this
that's
information.
That's where the line in the sand is, right?
That's right.
RSO. I mean,
you know, it's such a stigmatizing identification, sex offense. And so Jay has the choice he's facing is, do I cast out this man who's got this background, or do I, he can no longer stay in the church. It's jeopardizing the whole program. What do I do? And he decides to invite that man to sleep in his home. And I think that's a reflection of Jay's true principles. You know, most of us probably, again, wouldn't make that choice. But Jay, I think, really wanted to offer this person, Keith, help.
Mm-hmm.
And he does at great cost, because that decision does come back to haunt him.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to say that there is a kind of bait and switch of thinking we're going to really tell the story of these men who we do meet, and I think we get to know in very powerful ways, but the film ends up, the story ended up being for me much more about Jay, his life, his decisions, the risks he was taking, and he becomes really the heart and soul of the film.
We're not quite sure, but we're looking at possibly asking people to stay out of the parking lot until 8 o'clock at night.
Okay.
I think that would give some comfort to the neighbors.
Yes.
The one other thing is, we are going to call a moratorium on people that have KISS seat covers. If you're going to have that, I think you need to find another church.
Well, you wouldn't want to see me dressed up as Gene Simmons.
I wouldn't. Believe me, that would be the end of it. We wouldn't do that. And my other suggestion, I say this all the time, cut the hair. I'm serious. I think that, I am serious, very serious. And that's not a requirement, but I got to tell you, appearance means something.
Did Jesus have short hair?
Jesus doesn't have our neighbors. I cannot promise you a place in the building. I'm sorry. The fact is, you have a vehicle. Many people don't even have that. They don't have a car. And I got Jamie in that car and her John, the guy. I let him back in the building. Okay. All right. Okay. Write it down somewhere because I'll forget about it. Okay. Okay. Thanks. Good night. God bless.
I just saw another film, and it's a company further from this story. It's three generations of families rooted from, you know, from the Holocaust, like this family divides, and half the family is and goes to Israel, and the other half ends up in Germany. And it's called Farewell, Herr Schwartz. I keep coming back to it, but the main character also emerges from the story. You think it's about one thing, and then yet the daughter of the Holocaust survivor, who is also the mother of the filmmaker, is caught in between these two generations and her loyalty. You know, and her emotional loyalties, and she emerges as the real heart and soul of the film, and the way you talk about Pastor Jay does as well. You know, so it's an interesting thing to see parallels like that in films. And yeah. So go check that one out.
Well, it was important. You know, what I wanted to do with this film and really the project of this movie was to get back to the freedom I felt with my first film was shooting a cinema verite film. Like really shooting life happening in front of me, not a film of interviews of people talking about events that happened off camera, but really to be there in these people's lives and to film those moments and the profound moments, the funny moments, the intimate moments, the surprising moments. And I wanted to make a film like that. I felt a little old fashioned, but I think the great potential of that approach is that there are the great unexpected turns of life and allowing yourself to just
be open.
Be open,
but at the same time, on some level you're teasing out something because you have this innate sense. I mean, that's what makes a filmmaker a storyteller, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I recognize that Jay was our way into this narrative. That you know, his drama was his attempts to balance these forces told us a lot about what was happening in North Dakota, but also it told us a lot about this. I think this. Bigger choice, you know, that reflects back on this act of loving thy neighbor, you know, what that means. So I felt like it had gone beyond a story of North Dakota. But yet it felt very, sometimes I struggled with the fact that this was a very small story in a way, you know, an intimate human scaled story. And it didn't, you know, I think it's an epic story and it's a kind of epic tragedy in a way, but it also felt very small sometimes. And I struggled with that. I thought, you know, are people going to relate to Jay? Is this what they expect to see? Because it's not what you expect to see when you go into a film about the North Dakota oil boom. You think it's going to be about roughnecks, right, on a drilling rig with hard hats, and suddenly we're inside a church with this pastor and ministering to these men,
and in his basement, and in his own basement, and in his own house,
and in his heart.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, you keep, no pun intended, but you keep drilling down, you know, as you.
Yeah,
get through this process,
and you see what, to borrow that metaphor, the kind of human fracking dimension of this great transformation that we're experiencing in America with the unleashing of this potential for new resources beneath our feet. But the human, what is the effect of all of that change and transformation on individual human lives, on these small communities, on families? And that's in part what this film is about. I think is like. The human toll.
The Overnighters. It premiered at Sundance. Did it?
We premiered at Sundance.
Was it Sundance?
At Sundance? Okay. Yeah, that was very exciting for me. Never been to Sundance as a director, but feeling like I'd labored long in the trenches to get there, and this was the right film. I mean, it was a film where I felt like big risks financially, creatively, personally, and they took the film. It was very exciting. Jay came to the world premiere, Pastor Jay. And
that was my next
He was a
question.
He's been a big part of the film's public life, and he's a very brave person. To his credit, he's made this leap of faith and shared a lot about himself. And he's, I think he's really gotten a lot of affirmation. I think, you know, one of the things you discover in the film is, well, how hard he fights against people in the community who resent him or resent this program and try to shut it down. And I won't spoil the outcome, but there's, let's just say there are a lot of people in this community of Williston who would just as soon forget this ever happened. And the film tells the story and shares that story, and I think inspires people in a way to understand the value of what Jay did, to open his heart, to believe in, to provide compassion to people. I think the way Jay would put it probably is there is a choice between fear and compassion, you know, and the community chooses to fear and he chooses compassion, and a high price. But I think that's a valuable message.
But is it your sense that as a result of participated in The Overnighters, the film, that he feels at this stage, I mean, clearly he's supporter of the film, but do you feel he is also living authentically?
Is he living authentically?
I mean, is he doing better?
Well, here's what Jay's life as a result of the Overnighters program and as a result of this film has been utterly transformed. I mean, I'd say first and foremost because of what he did in starting this program and what it cost him in his life. It cost him almost everything. And so he's not the same person. And yet he's an optimist. He used to say when we were making the film, he's a bit of a corny guy in a way. And he would say, Jesse, he's like, I believe in plan B, you know, plan B is plan blessing. And I thought, that's so damn corny. This is a guy who like dances the hokey pokey too. But you know, he that's how he's looked at his misfortune and his turns, in life. And the film is that he just accepts it, you know, in the way that he accepted the Overnighters. You know, he sees the best. He does. He sees and he sees the benefit of telling this story to America, because it's not the kind of story, the kind of history that really gets told in any official way. It's a small story, but I think he's glad that we have. You know, it seems almost dreamlike to him that it happened, mm-hmm. and he did those things. And I said, Jay, no, I was there. I filmed it. You know, that was the great thing about. Mm-hmm. Making this film is like we were there to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And even though you'd go to that church today and there'd be no trace of any of the 1,000 men and women who slept in this room, you'd have no sense of the life that was there, you know, the pain, the love, the community that existed for 2 years that the program was in operation. You'd have no idea of what happened there, mm-hmm. and how many lives were helped and yet, the film is a kind of monument to that story, hopefully.
And it is now, I guess, what we're looking next for. It's had a theatrical.
We're still in our theatrical life.
Life around the country.
With Draft House and distributing. And we're in mostly secondary markets now. But actually, people, it's a smaller, you know, it's a film that's kind of percolated and with critical support. And so we've probably been in 50 markets, which is great for a documentary, I think. And we've got a true theatrical release with Draft House. They really believe in the film. It's a hard film to market. It's a hard film to talk about in a way because there's a lot going on. I mean, to me, you know, it's a film. I think I'd like to think maybe, how do I say this? It you know, it has like a complexity of a novel in a way. And I think I think often, you know, there are documentaries that are very binary and they're kind of black, white, you know,
messaging,
you know, and I think this is a film of ambiguities and complexities and unresolved questions and with twists and turns that I think are very novelistic. And so that's great, but it's also a little hard to tell people what it's, you know, to reduce it to its marketable tagline. You know, I mean, we've tried. So anyway, we're still out in theaters. We're going to be, eventually we'll be online, of course, and on public television next fall. But right now you can see us in the theaters.
Is that POV or does that mean
that's
independent
POV.
Lens?
Oh, yeah, okay. We're on POV.
POV.
Which I love, and my first film Speedo was on POV, and
was it?
They really, you know, they're a great partner.
When is that again? When is it broadcast?
It's fall. We don't have an air date, but it'll be fall 2015.
But you'll have a digital release anyway.
Yeah, we'll be on iTunes and Netflix in a couple months. I think in February. So about a month.
That's right. We'll put this up then. I think that makes sense. I get right, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'll get the date from Draft House for you.
Okay, great. Oh, well, it also has been shortlisted.
It's shortlisted.
As we speak.
It's shortlisted for the Oscar.
And I guess your Netflix, Amazon, all this stuff is around the time of the Oscar. So
yeah.
We don't know if he'll be nominated, but you know that must feel good and can't hurt the word of mouth. You know, people that look at those such things.
That helps. We've had some real passionate champions, critical champions, and we'll see.
Mm-hmm. The documentary is called The Overnighters, and it's directed by Jesse Moss, who happened to be in New York City on this coldest weekend we've had in a long time.
I lost my hat. I'm devastated. Oh, but I got a hoodie, so I'll be okay.
Okay. It's and they sell hats.
They do. We can get a hat in New York. Yeah. I'll get a hat.
And pretty much every street corner. Or since you're in the hotel in Times Square here, you can also go to a souvenir store and get
I Heart New York.
Yeah. There are a few of those.
Yeah.
You have various sports teams, I'm sure.
Jets. I got a Jets hat.
Oh, are you?
I'm not a pro football fan at all.
Okay.
But, it's great to talk to you about the film, Adam. Thank you. And
we'll do this again soon.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'm the one who's taking the risk here.
You're going to nosedive. There's some things you're getting ready to hit the fan.
There was a large manipulation that went on.
I'm out here to save my family, and it's probably going to cost my family.
I will not give in to despair, because hopeless should never win, and hopeless is a lie.
And last up here, it is Seeds of Time. If you're interested in watching this film, please, please give it a shot. It is available through Kino Lorber. If you're interested in the subject, I recommend it. But here is my conversation with the filmmaker, Sandy McLeod.
I'm not sure why it happened, but it really dawned on me that agriculture was going to face a gigantic challenge with climate change, and that agriculture was not ready.
I haven't had a normal career, that's for sure.
You realize you've got a limited amount of time to accomplish some things.
I was talking to a friend, and we came up with this idea.
Deep inside an Arctic mountain is a multi-$1 million seed bank. It was built to protect food crops from man-made and natural disasters, and it's been described as a frozen garden of Eden.
Most of us take seeds for granted. The fate of humankind is resting on these genetic resources, seeds. So nothing could be more important.
These are pretty good, by the way.
I'm going to have it. Oh, are you kidding me? What is this called?
I think it's a Sunomono.
Sunomono. Is that like...
Don't quote me on that.
Okay. Well, nobody can.
Off the
there's
record.
No graphic, so there's no. So nobody can possibly challenge you.
They're not a clementine.
They look like a clementine, but they're darker in color, mm-hmm. a little less. They're a little heavier in. So there's more density here. Mm-hmm. Like you know, when you open a clementine, and it's a lot of air under mm-hmm. the skin, you know, under the rind, you know. But they look exactly the same when you at the fruit itself.
The clementines have been bothering me because I notice a little. Maybe, and they're from Spain, and I know they're not regulated in terms of pesticides or anything. Uh-huh. And I get this little tingle
on
my
tongue.
It's an allergy.
Do you notice that? Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, that's from pesticides. Yeah, you get a tingle or a numbing.
Like a numbness.
Yeah. That's absolutely. I once ate an apple, maybe once or twice, and I had my lips were numb, and I realized I didn't wash it well enough. You know, they even recommend now, like, you know, soap when you're washing it. I mean, I don't usually do that, to be honest.
But a clementine, you peel the skin off.
Yeah, I know, but that's, yeah.
But this does not have that, just FYI.
Thank you, Sandy McLeod. Just to finish my prior thought, which mm-hmm. was a meeting on January, it's like the 15th of January, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And
15-15, maybe that's auspicious, I don't know.
I don't know. If somebody out there interested in things astrological, let us know. But I have a good sense of this already. We have a nice vibe going here. Just looking through the nominations this morning, it's very the criticism that you read on the Twitter feeds and the Facebook feeds is that it's very pale and very male. True, I will say there's always that is an ongoing issue, but and it's a valid issue. But on the second look at it or are looking from a different point, there's nothing really slight in that list of best picture Oscar category. All of the nominations, it was very indie-spirited group of films, but also all the films there's no big Hollywood splash. I mean, the closest thing is the Clint Eastwood American Sniper, but even that, I haven't seen it yet, but even that, to me, yeah, say what you will, it looks like it may be Hollywood, but it looks like there's some real sort of meat on the bone. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's, have you seen it? You probably had to, right?
I have, yeah. I wouldn't say it's his best work, but it's certainly it's not a typical Hollywood film by any stretch of the imagination. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of some of the things that he's done and other things I kind of scratch my head at. So,
Yeah. The Jersey Boys maybe is one you're scratching your head about. I don't know. I didn't see it either. But thank you for inviting me to your home.
My pleasure. I'm glad it's, really it's nice. Quiet here.
So comfortable. I may just move in.
There's room for you.
We're here. All I say is that we're in Soho on a cobblestone
block.
We're
actually in Tribeca.
Tribeca, excuse me. Of course we are. I don't know what I was thinking. Let me say that again. I should know this by now. We're in Tribeca on a cobblestone street. It's one of the beautiful old, like, kind of that people think about when they think about.
A lot of movies have been shot on this block, especially when El Teddy's was at the end of the street. Oh. Do you remember that?
Was it a bar?
It was a building that I think it was a Spanish artist.
Oh, yeah.
Opened a restaurant there, and it had a sort of like a spotted front, and it had the crown of the Statue of Liberty on top.
Okay. Yes, I do call that.
It was once in the credits for Saturday Night Live, and it became this sort of iconic image of
one
the neighborhood.
Of those. Yes, I do.
And then they tore it.
Do you remember when Lone Star Cafe was on Fifth Avenue up in the village? The iguana on the top of that building?
Yes.
That was another. All these institutions.
But come and they go.
But on a day like today, when you're walking over here, it still feels like the old New York that you probably remember from back in the day, and then I do.
It was the old New York that I remember was a lot funkier than this one.
Yeah.
This one has been scrubbed within an inch of its life.
It's true. But was it when you moved in here in the 70s, was it sort of shady?
Well, I grew up in Alabama. When I came to New York, I needed to have a place that I felt was more quiet because I couldn't.
Quiet.
I didn't adapt very easily at first to the hustle and bustle. I was slow speaking and, you know, I was just on a different speed. You guys were all on 78 and I was on 33.
Did you move here after school?
No, I dropped out of school.
Mm-hmm.
I got in a lot of trouble in school. I almost got lynched when I was in school.
This was also in Alabama?
This was in Georgia.
Okay.
In a small town in Georgia.
Really?
Yeah. And
because
I was
look
a freshman
like an
and I it was 67, 68 and I had a date with a senior who happened to be black and we went to the school play and it just caused this. I mean, I was pretty naive. I guess I thought I was raised in the South and I lived in Birmingham during all the civil rights stuff, and so I guess I thought it was over. You know, I guess I thought, okay.
67, 68, you thought it was over.
Well, I don't know. I thought we were going to move on to the war and other big issues, you know.
Yeah. That's definitely your noises. Okay. That's amazing. I was going to ask you, because also today, which is, the 15th of January, happens to be Martin Luther King's birthday. Today is his actual birthday, and he would have been 86.
Wow. That's something to think about. Yeah.
And last night I actually watched a 3-hour documentary, which you're probably familiar with, called King, a Film Record. It's all archive, I don't know if they would have called it archive at the time. It was made in 1970, but it's all just footage from Birmingham to Memphis.
I would love to see that.
Oh, I have a copy with me, but I'm meeting with the filmmaker after this.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, he lives just blocks away.
Really?
Yeah, Richard Kaplan. He's being distributed by Lorber, like Seeds of Time.
Uh-huh.
And he's 90-something years old.
He is?
And he produced this film with Eli Landau, who is a very famous guy from the 70s, 60s, 70s, and probably before that, too. Yeah, it's an incredible story. Incredible. It's just what
it was an incredible time. You know, I was a kid, but I mean, just living in Birmingham during that time and seeing the things that I saw and sort of coming of age you know, I remember my parents moved when I was 12 mm-hmm. and to a smaller town in Alabama, and they took my brother with them, and I was supposed to finish my sixth grade year with staying at my girlfriend's house.
Really?
And which I did, and then I got on a bus to go to Dothan, Alabama. And I got on the bus, and I sat next to a little black girl who was my age, and we started, you know, sharing photographs. Because when you're a kid, you just don't think about things like that. And the bus driver, we were early. The bus driver hadn't started the bus. And before he started the bus, he came back to where we were sitting, and he looked at me, and he said, you don't have to sit with her. And I
remember this.
And I was so embarrassed for her and for me. Because, you know, and so I said, well, this is where I sat.
Right.
I chose to sit here.
Yeah.
And he just sort of stared at me for a while, and then finally he went back and he started the bus. So that was the beginning of it. And then I got off the bus. She got off the bus down a dirt road just before we got to Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
She had to ask him to let her off. And she was nervous about it, too, I remember.
I'm sure.
And then I got off in Montgomery to get some lunch. And when I got back on the bus, I noticed that it was really full, and I had to sit way in the back of the bus. And as people were getting out, I kept moving forward until I was sitting behind the driver. I was practically the only person on the bus. And I said, when do we get to Dothan? And he said, oh, my God, child, you're in Georgia. I had gotten back on the wrong bus. And so I said, well, I have to call my parents, you know, because my luggage was on the other bus, and it would have arrived by then. So I called my mother, who was in tears, and sure enough, you know, they called out the FBI, and, you know, my, you know,
sure.
It was that, and
that was the environment then.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Well, I'll decide that this documentary happens to be playing Film Forum Monday, coincidentally. I just happened to look at the Film Forum newsletter yesterday after or during while I was watching this thing. And it said that the same documentary, King, Film Record, I'm botching the name. It's 3 hours, but it's just really so powerful.
Mm.
It's so powerful. And through the bus boycotts in Montgomery, through the March on Washington, and
I'm amazed they could get that footage. You know, it's very
there.
Difficult.
Yeah.
The family has a lot of that stuff really tied up. So
yeah,
they must have.
Right. I guess Ava DuVernay couldn't even use any of that.
That's right.
Yeah. Just horrible. And by the way, they also go to Chicago, and it was worse than even in the South, the racism and the rioting. And then, I mean, the mobs were worse in Chicago. There's this candid footage of King talking about it, and you could see he was visibly shaken. And he was talking about the mobs in Chicago, the white mobs, were even worse than they were in Montgomery and Birmingham, which is something new to me. I didn't know until I saw this footage and the dogs and the hoses. But I felt almost bad for the white people, all that hate and poison. I mean, you know,
you
ultimately.
Mean in
I
the
have
South
my,
or in the yeah, North or wherever?
Everywhere. Just
well,
the toxicity
yeah.
and the kids and the generations afterwards who have to look back at their fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers, because their women were out there too, and look like, hopefully they'll understand the context and that they were raised with hate, you know, like your bus driver and, you know, just everything.
Yeah.
It's just awful.
No, it was...
Everybody was a victim on a certain level.
It was an incredible lesson, really, in a lot of ways to grow up with that, just to sort of... Because, you know... I understood racism on a level that I wouldn't have otherwise. And when I came to the North, I actually thought I was going to escape that.
Mm.
And I was really shocked because although no one here would call themselves a racist, there were no black people in my life whatsoever. I didn't know how to meet them. You know, I mean, it was like suddenly segregation was actually complete here.
Yeah, wow.
And that was a real
interesting.
Shock.
Interesting, yeah. I think you're right, exactly. I think that's something that we realized about the South is... It was just so much more integrated, but, you know, maybe...
It was integrated.
Obviously, the infrastructure, like, you know, voting, economics, jobs.
Right,
just, I mean, obviously, the facilities, things of that nature were all segregated. But people lived and interacted among each other a lot more. And it's true to this day.
Yeah.
I think that I don't want to... get too far in that because I can't really speak on it quite as well, even though I was in a, you know, I was married and had in-laws. And that was a real life changer because even if I think of yourself as a progressive, liberal, non-racist as well, you don't really know what it is until you're living it on a daily basis and trying to create a family and what that all
everything.
That means. And yeah,
I mean, until, you know, just because of the way people, they don't know how to relate to it, or
exactly, they don't have the language, even just the basic kind of understanding of it. But it's a gift once you do it. Once you can commit to it. So, wow, I guess we got a little off topic.
We did. We're on but, another movie.
Kind of, right? But, well, but we can continue at least with the biographical part, because you moved to New York. It doesn't sound like you knew you wanted to be a filmmaker yet, right? So how'd you trip into that?
I didn't even think of that as a possibility.
Who did, right?
I thought maybe I'd be a policewoman or something like that. You know, that was
you
more.
Did?
Yeah. That was more my... line of thinking.
Wow. I can't see it.
Yeah, no, it was a, I was discovered as a model when I first came to New York, which was awful for me because I was also one of the things that got me out of the South, besides racism, was sexism. Okay. And so I had, I had grown very fond of, the notion of feminism because I was under the thumb of the patriarchy in the South. And I thought, oh, wow, look at this. Other women are as pissed off about this as I am.
Yeah.
And although, you know, over time it didn't stick because I began to realize that you can't replace a patriarchy with a matriarchy. And that we both had our issues we needed to address. When I was discovered as a model, it was like, holy shit, what do I do? You know, like,
what were you approached at a drugstore or like
I was,
walking
yeah,
down the
I
street?
Was, I was asked by a photographer.
Because I could say to, and the people listening, she's very fetching, very beautiful woman here. So I could see that
this is,
you really kept your looks very, very well.
Well,
very,
you look great. Thank you. That's very sweet of you to say.
Sure.
So I was approached by a photographer on the street to take some pictures, and he happened to be a nice guy. He looked kind of like Benjamin Franklin. And there was something about him that I trusted. And I was open. You know, I was from the South. You were friendly to people that approached you. So he took some pictures. We took him to Wilhelmina and Ford, and they both wanted to sign me up.
Wow.
But I had to put a book together and do all that. And I was never very successful at it because, as I said, I had a real sort of moral dilemma.
Where'd that come from? Just,
I think it came from the idea of not wanting to be objectified. But I also,
But even that,
but I think
like
that came from my brother had muscular dystrophy, and it really deformed his body over time, and he was my teacher, he was my mentor. You know, I knew how smart he was and how. Clever he was, and I also knew that people would look at him and feel pity, and people would look at me and say, "Oh, what a cute, you know, adorable little girl," and I knew that that was not really what was going on at all. I mean, you know, it was only the surface of it. So I got that lesson, I think, really early on. It was, and I didn't even know that I got it, but I did. And in a way, I think it was lucky because I think when you're that young and you fall into that and you don't know that, it can really mess you up.
That's powerful, you know, just, learning that at that time in that place, it just, and your brother long since, is he gone?
He died when he was 22.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were considering the police academy that didn't, actualize.
No, I didn't. I never really, I needed to make money. I had saved some money from the modeling stuff and I sort of hold myself in for about 6 months. I didn't know what to do. I would say it was the only time in my life that I ever came close to being agoraphobic or became agoraphobic. And during that time, I did a lot of soul searching, and I knew I couldn't go back down south. And I saw I had a few really strange jobs. Like I worked in the Time Life building for a textile company that was going bankrupt or seemed to. No, they needed the company I was working for as a tax write-off for another company. So I was the receptionist at a place that no one ever came to and no one ever called.
Sort of a smoke screen.
And so I was in the front office and there was a little back room and there was a guy back there who would drop acid every day and glue swatches of fabric onto cards. And so that was one job. And then I got a job as a librarian in a recording studio. And it was National Recording. It was on Fifth Avenue. And that was a really exciting job for me. And I got really interested in sound. And the sound effects library was a mess. It was really disorganized. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I could learn how to work the machines at night and I could sort of clean it up. And one night they mixed Gimme Shelter there. And I had never seen sound mixed to picture. And
was, can I ask if, Al Measles or David?
Yeah, they were there.
They were there.
I didn't know who they were. I didn't really have a, a large cinema vocabulary in those days.
Nobody knew who they were until much more recently.
And, but I watched them and I remembered thinking, maybe I'm more visual, you know, like, could I learn how to make films? And I got a job as a receptionist at a film company as a result of that. And it took me, I agreed to work in the front for a year before they would let me be a PA on the set. They were sort of mortified by me because I was so anti-fashion at that point. I was wearing Earth shoes and jeans and flannel shirts.
Well this into was, the 70s now, obviously?
This was in the early 70s.
Okay.
And I remember they bought me a pair of shoes for Christmas because they really wanted me to perk up my look.
Subtle. Yeah.
And then at the end of the year, I went to that producer and I said,
okay.
My year's up.
Yeah.
And he actually started crying and he said, oh God, Sandy, you're the first person I've told this, but we've gone bankrupt and we're not going to be around. I'm about to announce to everyone that we're going to have to close the shop.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I gave him some sympathy, but I also said, well, listen, you know, do you think maybe you could just say, like for me, since I never got there, that I was a PA, so I could at least put that on my resume?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got a job as an assistant to a producer at, and I was in way over my head because I had no idea even what all the crew people did, you know? So I remember throwing up each morning before I go to that job because I was going to be hit with 20 different things that I'd have to get someone to define for me. And, you know,
Well, how ironic that's a talent that might have come in more handy as a model.
I know. It's true.
Kind of anxious because my hidden agenda is when I was looking over your bio on the press kit was that you worked for Jonathan or with Jonathan Demme on Stop Making Sense, which, you know, you might have a lot of great stories too, but in between, because it was a good 10 years till Stop Making Sense, well, that was a seminal film, I'm sure for you, but I mean, just for me, going to see that living in Boston at the time as a student and just going to the Harvard Square Cinema or wherever I saw it, going back and over and bringing everybody I knew to see that movie. That was just the best.
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible opportunity for us because we love the Talking Heads. And I'd done a lot of work with Jonathan at that point. And
well, how'd that happen?
I learned how to do continuity on films. And that's, I mean, I worked on, first started out on pornos, then I went to black exploitation films.
Okay.
I mean, I did some pretty nasty stuff. And then I got to work on Magic with Richard Attenborough in the New York.
Oh, I remember that. With Sir Hopkins. Anthony Hopkins, right?
Yeah.
And he's a psychopathic killer who...
Ventriloquist.
Well, actually, the right ventriloquist, but the dummy's the killer. Yeah. Or tells him what to do.
Yeah, yes, yes. Like well, that. He's got a little bit of a split going on.
Split personality type disorder, as you'd call it. So you worked on that.
I did second unit on that, which was a big break for me. And right after that, I started getting sort of legitimate films to do. You know, I worked with Jerry Schatzberg on The Seduction of Joe Tynan.
With Alan Alda.
And Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep, one of her first leading, she was a supporting role in that. She plays his wife, right? Or girlfriend.
She plays his girlfriend.
That's right. That's the affair, right?
Yes.
The seduction part. It wasn't his fault, after all.
Oh, no, of course not.
I do recall that movie, too.
And then I got, I worked on Last Embrace with Jonathan. That was the first film I did with him.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that one.
Well, it's not one of his better efforts.
Yeah. Was that before or after the
It one was with after Citizens Band.
Okay. And then before the one I'm thinking of.
Melvin and Howard.
Melvin and Howard.
Yeah, that's that I worked one. On with him.
Oh, wow. That's a great one.
And so you were, Something again, Wild. And
Great film.
Swimming to Cambodia. And,
great.
A bunch so you really of stuff. Did work a bunch of him. Stuff. Uh-huh. But when that picture came up, he was doing Swing Shift, which I wasn't working on.
You got him in quite a group of films there.
Yeah.
Really great run there. You know, with the exception of the Silence of the Lambs, I guess.
Yeah, no, that one he did after. But when the opportunity to do that film came along, he was shooting Swing Shift, and Goldie Hawn was a big star at the time. The studio had given her a Rolls Royce Corniche, you know, when she finished the picture, and she'd fallen in love with Kurt Russell while they were doing that movie, and she wanted to change the movie as a result of that, because it was really a story about her and Christine Lottie's character. And that was the strength of the film. It was these women working, without men after they'd gone to war. And so she, because of the power that she had, she eventually got them to agree to do a rewrite. And Jonathan had to shoot those scenes, which was really horrible for him. I still have somewhere his original cut of that film, which is a much better.
I've not seen that movie either. Because I think I just thought it was probably slight because of, Goldie Hawn was often very funny, but most of her movies, not so great. She did one or two that were, So I just didn't see it.
Yeah. Well, and, you probably shouldn't bother. If I can dig up this other version, you might want to see that. So he had to do those reshoots while we were supposed to be shooting Stop Making Sense. So that made it very complicated. So he brought me on to go on the road with them and start to figure out how to shoot the show. And so that was I couldn't believe it. It was just like, if ever there was a time in my life where, it was like a dream came true, because I love the Talking Heads.
Yeah.
I remember seeing them in Central Park with the B-52s.
Not Forest Hills, but they did Central Park.
They did Central Park. And my husband grew up with the drummer from the Talking Heads, so Chris France. Yeah.
Chris France, yeah.
Yeah. So
those were all, after that movie came out, they were all
Oops.
That's okay.
Sorry.
You can pause if you need to see who that is.
Funny. Right on cue.
It was. It's too bad David Byrne didn't call.
Yeah.
What was he like?
David?
Back then, yeah.
Well, he's a very different person now, I would have to say.
Right. He's a bit of an industry.
He's become more social.
Yeah.
I
mean, he had his own label. He does all sorts of art project collaborations with different,
he's an extraordinary talent.
His
Here Lies Love. He's writing another show now, another Broadway show.
Wow. He's
incredibly prolific. I can't keep up with everything that he does. Usually I know, but a book came out, the bike book came out recently, and that's completely, I didn't know he was even writing that one. So he's really a force. And he's come more and more into his own as he's gotten older, and diversified, and his talent seems to know boundaries. Yeah. Really. It's great. It's a wonderful thing to see.
But back then, he was more shy, quite reserved. Is that as he sort of comes off?
Yeah.
Like kind of more mystique there, I guess.
And he had just fallen in love when we started doing that film. Uh-huh. To the woman that he later married and had a child with. And my sense is that she sort of socialized him, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, falling in love changes you anyway.
Having a child does, of course.
Too, yes. Who I would say is still the love of his life.
Sure, know, yeah. Used to see him running around in the bike, of course, with the kid on the back seat. Mm-hmm. If you live in New York, you kind of would just see David Byrne.
Yeah.
Eventually, or in Paris, or a couple other spots.
Yeah, and you know, he would put his bike on the bus and ride over all over. I mean, he knows American cities probably as well as anybody, just because he rides his bike so much.
Sure, yeah, that was a remarkable film. Just how they built the that concert, which I know was a couple of different, or two or three different, or maybe more performances, but it was a couple of performances, right? At least
there were three.
Oh, three. Okay.
I mean, you know, the interesting thing about that show was that the show was never really, as far as I know, designed to be made into a movie. That was just the way that he designed the show. He wanted it to build. He wanted it to have sort of this theatrical aspect to it. So it starts out very stark and builds and builds.
And he's supposed to be alone, solitude there. And then kind of introduce more social
layers to it. And the lighting is very
naked
and bare. Yeah. And, yes. It just so happened that it, you know, lent itself beautifully to a film.
Yeah.
And we were lucky enough to be able to get to do that. But there was a lot of controversy even in the band about doing it. You know, they were not all happy to be doing it. And it was fraught.
It seems like Jerry Harrison, keyboards, might have been the one who maybe. And then maybe Chris and Tina were a little bit of a fraction because... I don't know. Is that what happened?
I don't know.
I'm not looking for like gossip from the time.
Right.
They were just, it was like most bands. You get a shelf life. I mean, it's not normal to be around very long.
Chris and Tina had done the Tom Tom Club.
That's right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
The Tom Tom Club, when we made Stop Making Sense, were bigger than the Talking Heads. They had already gone platinum.
Well, they had a huge hit, a popular hit, whereas the Talking Heads had Burning Down the House, which was a minor popular hit. I mean, it was
they were not nearly as well known, and so that's why there were, I think originally, I don't know if there are two Tom Tom Club songs in the movie. I can't remember.
I only remember one from the album.
We shot two, but maybe there's one. I don't remember. But that's why they were in there. It was because we were hoping to get those audiences to come to see the film.
Well, it's a great film, and I don't want to take up, you know, the entire, a lot of your time on too much of that, but I did want to talk about it because it is, like, even to this day when I start hearing it, and eventually, and I never got to see him live because I don't know what reason, but finally, 10 years ago or something, I went to see him and something, and he opened his mouth and he started singing, and it just sort of turned on this emotional, you know, whole thing, and I just got so choked up from seeing him finally singing live in front of me these songs that I loved, even though it wasn't with the Talking Heads at that point. Anyway, it's a great, great, you know, huge thing. And a lot of people my age, and, you know, that was a huge, huge film.
Yeah, to this day, I love that music, and I can still look at that film and be really proud to be part of it.
Yeah. So what was your official credit on that?
My credit was visual consultant, which was...
Well, it was beautiful.
I made up credit because we didn't know what to call me. Jonathan said, well, you can be a producer or you could... And I thought, well, I want a more creative credit than that, which is probably a huge mistake. Producer probably would have been a better.
On that, yeah. Hindsight, but you're...
Anyway, that's what my credit is, visual consultant.
Agriculture is in danger. The whole world is in danger. We need to learn to adapt. If we don't, we'll face catastrophic consequences on a scale we cannot imagine.
It's being called a natural disaster of epic proportion.
We are seeing those first signs that Mother Nature is sending food prices higher.
The way in which we're feeding the current population is not sustainable.
We're trying to teach the world how to save itself. We're really in a race against time. We need to mobilize.
before it's too late.
We're going to pay a price if we don't do the smart thing and help agriculture adapt.
Well, to fast forward a little bit, how many films have you directed?
This is my first.
This is your
feature-length documentary. Yeah.
It is. Wow, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. So and it must be very rewarding to finally be able to do this.
After all these years, yeah. It was a slog, let me tell you. I hope it's not this hard for everybody.
it probably is for most, right? Yeah, to finance this thing, I'm sure that was no pleasure. It must have been really hard to do.
Well, that's why it took so long. Yeah.
How long did it take?
6 years.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay. Seeds of Time is about the threat on the on our agriculture. What do we call it? Agrarian or agriculture? What's the right term?
Either one. Agriculture is
on agriculture.
Fragile.
World agriculture. Yeah. That it's in a delicate place right now, because of global warming and other environmental realities.
There are so many threats on agriculture that it's almost like a perfect storm for a disaster.
Seeds of Time explores this specifically through
Carrie Fowler.
You can hold my hand
through
this.
You can cut it out later.
Okay. And this is a man who's dedicated his life to helping, preserving seeds in the word. I mean, that's really what he does, right?
You know,
a scientist.
If I had to think of one thing that a single human has done that probably affects every single other human on the planet.
Yeah.
There aren't many things I can think of other than this seed vault that have that kind of incredible impact.
Mm-hmm.
What he saw, along with quite a few other people, was that after we started doing industrial farming and stopped growing out all the little varieties that we used to eat, you know, this country was a country of immigrants, and they all brought their seeds. That's what they wanted, because they wanted to be able to eat those foods here, bring them with them, use the same recipes.
Mm-hmm.
But with monocropping and industrial farming, all of those seeds got eaten or lost, or those farmers couldn't grow them, didn't grow them anymore, didn't. Next generation wanted Wonder Bread, you know, whatever.
Right. They didn't need 20 varieties of potatoes or tomatoes or corn. They just wanted the tasty yellow one, or the tasty red one. Right, but they didn't understand by choosing.
They would fit in the can, or, you know.
I see, yeah. The brightest and the sweetest, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that kind of edged out all those other varieties, but in doing so,
over 80 years, we lost everything except somewhere between 3 and 7% of our food.
That's incredible. I had no idea about this.
And so, no, people don't know this. So Carrie, you know, along with a number of other people, saw this happening and thought, well, you know, what are we going to do? So there are seed banks around the world. Most of the greatest diversity existed in the developing world. Seed banks, the easiest way to save a seed is to freeze it.
Okay. Like in Southeast Asia.
There were seed banks in the Philippines. One of the biggest ones for rice is in the Philippines, taken out by the tsunami. You know, there are seed banks in Africa, in Ethiopia, that...
How do they freeze them there, though? Or is it just in
deep freezers, but power outage, and they're gone.
Right.
And power outages happen in those countries all the time. Yeah. So Carrie's idea was really to back up those seed vaults. And that's what that seed vault in the Arctic Circle is about, is making a duplicate copy, because they're like a little hard drive.
Yeah.
You know, that information is just on that seed. And that's what that vault does.
Very kind of science fiction, you know. He goes out there during the film, and he goes there to give us a tour of it. So all these seeds are being backed up, basically, because they all have, like, the genetic makeup, whatever the version of a seed.
We don't know. I mean, that's the thing about climate change. We don't know what's going to happen. The bitch about climate change is is it going to get warmer? Is it going to get colder? Like from one season to the next, farmers don't really know anymore. So as that starts to swing around wildly, it's going to be harder and harder for them to know.
Yeah.
And but we need all the genetics we can possibly cobble together.
Yeah, it's sort of the Noah's Ark of vegetation.
Mm-hmm. Of right. Food.
Food.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Survival.
And it's, you know, it's secure. It's high enough that even if everything melts, it'll still be above the water line. It's cold enough that even if the power fails, the generators fail, it will still be cold. They'll still be cold enough.
Wow.
So.
Yeah. It's remarkable. So to take me back a little bit, how did you first learn about Carrie and what he was doing, and why did you feel compelled to make this documentary then?
It's a kind of peculiar story. I was sent the article by two people, which is really unusual.
Two different people.
One of them was David, by the way. And I was reading it one morning at breakfast. Mm-hmm.
David Byrne, by the way.
My husband was on a phone call on the speakerphone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading about Carrie Fowler, and I think the article was called The Doomsday Vault or something like that, written by this guy, John, I just blanked on his name, John Seabrook.
Seabrook.
I think that's right.
Yeah, I see that. I think that's...
I'm reading about Carrie Fowler, and I hear my husband, you know, saying, yes, Carrie, you know, but I don't think really much about it. And then I read this line that says, Carrie Fowler was given $30 million by the Gates Foundation to collect the seeds for the seed vault. And I hear my husband say to the guy on the phone, so how much did you get from the Gates Foundation? And I hear the guy on the phone say, $30 million. So I'm like, huh? So Sam hangs up the phone, and I look at him, and I say, was that Carrie Fowler by any chance that you were speaking to on the phone? And he was like, he looked at me, and he said, yeah. Mm-hmm. He said, how the heck do you know Carrie Fowler?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I'm reading about him. How do you know him?
Mm-hmm.
So it was this really funny thing of, I mean, kind of when that kind of synchronicity happens in your life, at least for me, I really can't ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned so much from reading that article. I thought of myself as a foodie, you know, like I'm interested in food, and I realize, you know.
From an impact, sort of, from a, you know, in a global impact kind of.
I like to take meals with people. I like to think about, you know, I grew up in the South. I think about where it comes from and what impact it has on the earth. Because I lived in cotton country, which is the most polluting thing you can grow. On a few different levels, you know, it was a topic that I was pretty interested in. But everything in this article was new to me. I had never thought really much about seeds, except Monsanto, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never thought about how fundamental they are to agriculture, which sounds like a no-brainer, but I just hadn't gone there. I didn't know there were seed banks. I didn't know that people save, that I didn't know about centers of diversity. I didn't, you know, there were so many things that are attached to something that is fundamental to putting food on the table that I didn't know, that it really sort of shocked me. And then this added thing of this loss of biodiversity was like, yikes, you know, people need to know about this stuff because you can't really be fully informed if you don't.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
So, I elected to go to Memphis to meet Carrie. He happened to be there that summer. His parents lived there, and he was living in Rome at the time, just to see what he would be like as a subject. And the poor guy, it was 110. I wanted to shoot him on his screened-in porch. I had to finally put his feet in a bucket of ice water because it was so unbearable out there to do the interview. But he suffered through it. It was like an 8-hour interview. And I had read this book that he had written, and, you know, again, it was just like one thing after another that I didn't know. And I thought, people need to know this. But what I found was that people in the film industry were not really very interested in agriculture and saw it as a sort of boring, dull topic.
Right.
And people who were interested in agriculture and understood the importance of the issue had no money for funding films. So it was tough in the beginning, but I just would shoot a little, piece something together, shoot a little more. And, you know, and I was, it was a huge learning curve for me too, because I was trying to figure out, you know, what is the essential part of this story? Because there were a lot of little rat paths I went, you know, wandering along.
Right. Yeah. And you didn't have a, you didn't have someone to help guide you in this, in this.
I had Carrie.
Right.
And
well, from a filmmaking standpoint, I mean, I know you've been on many sets, obviously, and you know, worked with some of the best. But this was your first time going it alone. But and then I assume, I guess Abigail Disney, who's the executive producer, maybe she was, that was later.
That was at the end.
That was at the end of the process.
Yeah,
that might have been ideal had it been like somebody like obviously has done so much in the documentary world.
But I wasn't. Earlier, but, you know, it's true that it was my first. But you know, I've been,
wouldn't know it from looking at it though.
I've been,
it looks great.
Thank you.
And it's very holds together really well. You know, and
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was tough because I couldn't really afford to have, I was concerned about the look of it, and I couldn't afford to have one person shoot it, even though eventually I found this Danish guy who I tried to get as often as I could because he was really good, and he was young, and he'd been a skateboarder and started shooting by shooting his tricks, and then got too damaged to do it anymore. And he had that, you know, beautiful Danish eye for sort of design.
Right.
And he was willing to, you know, get down in the dirt with the Peruvian potato farmers. And
right. Well, we're going to bring that up too. This is one of the threads in the film is following the community of these Peruvian agrarians. I mean, they're farmers, but they're just, they're growing. It's like their backyard too. Cause And it goes up the, it's in this part of the country where it goes up the mountain and the climate is too warm and they have to keep going further up the mountain to get the right climate, right, to continue to be able to make their potatoes crops. And they figure it out a solution over the course of the film, right, like how to deal with this issue. And it becomes, of course, a way of everybody can leverage their what they learned.
It becomes a collaboration with indigenous people and science, which, you know, we really need more of.
Yeah, it's there's a contrast moment where one moment we're looking out on the fields and these indigenous, beautiful indigenous people, the clothing and they're working out there. And then you go to this, like the lab, this very huge contrast. There's something very, you know, exciting about that partnership there, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's tremendous power, I think, in bringing those two things together.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And also, you know, as Carrie says, you know, the trust that it took for them to be willing to let the seeds go to Svalbard, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's the Russian.
No, Svalbard is.
That's the place in the Arctic Circle.
That's right.
Right. That's the tank.
Yes.
Gotcha. Right. I was confused because there is this also yet another thread about the Russian, like, I'm not going to pronounce
Vavilov.
It right. Vavilov.
Maybe it's Vavilov.
Vavilov is fine. Yes. And he, right, he was around the time of World War II
Leningrad. Petersburg.
St. Petersburg. Leningrad changed names over years, right? And, right, and he was the first to categorize, and he was like a librarian of seeds.
He was the first person that saw what was happening. That saw
way before.
Yeah, and he was, he was an international figure, and but unfortunately, it was happening right along the same time Stalin was coming into power, and because he was an aristocrat, he was a bourgeois member of society. He was eventually thrown in prison
and starved to death.
And unfortunately,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So it's a tragic story of someone who has done so much to save diversity for all of us that he starved to death in prison.
And during the course of the film, again, it's called Seeds of Time. Carrie Fowler, our guide through the film. He makes a trip there and walks through the original, which had been preserved, the original building where Vavilov, Vavilov worked.
Yes, I mean, the sad thing about that place is that now we're probably going to lose that, too, because the Russians are not really willing to fund it much longer. So
it's a
real tragedy because it's because of its history and because it should be a national treasure.
So when did you finish the film? When did you finally?
I finished the film at the end of 2013, just right at the very end.
Okay.
Yeah.
So fairly recently. And where did it premiere?
In Copenhagen.
Oh, at what's the name of it? Is it a documentary? The documentary? Anyway, yeah, in Copenhagen. Great, great.
We're gonna show it in February in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So
that's
we haven't
great.
Really showed it that much in Europe so far. We
right.
showed it at the Serpentine Gallery in London, but we got in Berlin, so that's really exciting.
What about New York?
New York, we showed it at Museum of Natural History at the UN.
It really has a life off the educational distribution, right?
It's an issue-driven film.
Right, sure it is, yeah.
And outreach and all that's going to be a really important part of this.
Absolutely, right. In fact, I know that you, if you go to the website, which, remind me of the website.
Seedsoftimemovie.com.
Seedsoftimemovie.com, that there is a very, lots of resources right there on the website, including a kit which you can download to help you put together a screening, which I think, makes sense, but it's a very well organized and, very helpful site.
And we're constantly working on it. And there's a lot of footage in there because I shot, I forget how many interviews, it must have been 120. And there's a tiny percentage of that are actually in the film. So a lot of that footage you can find too if you're interested in some aspect that you didn't get enough of,
Right.
It's a good source for research too.
Yeah. So you're going out to Berlin, I guess that's only in about 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's coming right up.
Mm-hmm. It is. And you can't actually, just FYI, I think we're not supposed to tell anyone until the 21st. But
oh, well.
We're not too far.
January 21st, that's
January
next 21st. Week,
yeah.
Right? Something like that. Yeah, I think we're okay.
Okay, good.
To talk about it because.
I just realized that.
Yeah. No, I think we're fine talking about it because I don't think this will probably go up until around that time. I'll make note of that. And did we leave anything essential out? I assume that Carrie goes to, like, when you're doing some of these things, you might organize, if he's available.
He does. He tries to go to as many of them as he can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his health?
His health is good.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty good. He's,
strong immune system, we learn.
Yes. Very incredible.
The odds were against him for.
Yeah. No, he's hanging in there.
Well. Driven, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you driven after this 6-plus-year project? Are you driven to make another documentary or another film?
Yes, I do. I mean, why should I stop now? What else am I going to do?
Go back to modeling. No, don't.
No.
It was really, I hope that was good. I hope you.
Yeah.
All right, good. And so visit the site, seedsoftimemovie.com. Check out this documentary. As you put it very well just before, this subject absolutely touches every single living person in the planet. And the planet, we've got to eat. Animals have to eat. We have to eat. So, and it's an under-discussed, right? It's like,
Sadly, I mean, I think that, almost intuitively, we have, there are those of us who, partly because of our socioeconomic possibilities, can go to farmers markets and like to know our farmers or can participate in CSAs and that kind of thing. But we need to do more and more of that. We need to, as consumers, start to drive what our grocery stores buy and where they buy it from, and to encourage them to not just have, you know, two varieties of lemons, but get us six, or, you know, because there are infinite possibilities in those things, and it will help help us survive when the weather gets wanky, which it's kind of doing.
Hate that wanky weather. Thank you so much for inviting me in here and sitting for this conversation. It was great to meet you.
Same.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. This has been episode number 276 of the podcast. I thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. We tweet, and you can find us and retweet us at the handle at filmwaxradio. But most importantly, you can go to filmwaxradio.com and get fill up all on your all your Filmwax Radio needs. And there's a link to the archive of past episodes. But, you know, most importantly of all, you can go to iTunes and you can listen to almost everything. It's all there. All you have to do is subscribe to the show. And while you're there, please leave us a comment and a star rating. A star rating. What it does is as many more people and more people add the star rating, of course, Filmwax Radio, the podcast, rises up the ranks and more people will discover the show, which is how one makes this show thrive. Thank you so much. I'm going to take my leave of you at this particular moment, but have a great weekend if you're listening to this at the beginning of your weekend, and keep warm as we head into March 2015. That's it, folks. So thanks. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. Filmwax Radio is the name of this podcast. We talk about independent film. The show is presented by Rooftop Films. Thank you for listening. Till next time, take care.